All right, if everyone will take their seats, we'll get underway. We'll call the Justice Appropriations Subcommittee to order, and Rosa, would you please call the roll?
Chair Brannon.
Here.
Vice Chair Smith.
Here.
Ranking Member Valdez.
Present.
Representatives Beltran.
Here.
Bracy Davis.
Here.
Campbell.
Here.
Duggan.
Here.
Fabricio.
Here.
Fernandez Barquin.
Here.
Gottlieb.
Here.
Jacques.
Here.
Saroy. Snyder.
Here.
Stark.
Here.
Waldron.
Here.
A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Rosa. I want to welcome everyone back to the Justice Appropriations Subcommittee. As always, ensure that our cell phones and other communication devices are turned off and or either on the silent mode. I also would say that to the audience that if anyone wants to speak to the subcommittee today, please fill out an appearance card and provide it to one of the sergeants, and they'll get it up here to Rosa, and we'll get you on the list. We'll hear from two presenters today to provide updates on a few of the issues impacting a pair of the departments that are under the committee's purview. On behalf of the state court system, we will hear this morning from Chief Judge Mark Mahan from the 4th Judicial Circuit to provide us with an update on the court case backlog as well as the pandemic recovery plan applied by the courts and its impact to the state court system. Following that, we'll hear from Secretary Ricky Dixon of the Florida Department of Corrections. He'll be here to provide the subcommittee an update on correctional officer recruitment and retention efforts within that department. At the conclusion of each presentation, we'll have a few moments for questions. So we will get on underway. We'll start with Judge Mahan. He'll come forward. Welcome. Judge Mahan certainly knows his way around the Capitol. He served in the legislature from, let me guess, about 2000 to 2007 or 8?
Yes, sir.
Pretty close?
Yes, sir. That's accurate.
And if I'm not mistaken, your father also served in the legislature.
Yes, sir. That was 53 and 55.
53 to 55.
Yes, sir.
And your grandfather was an attorney also?
Yes, sir. Yes,
obviously, he and I go pretty good ways back. We've worked some cases together, me as a deputy sheriff and him as an attorney. But he comes from a long line of attorneys. And I'll tell you this about his dad. I've been in the courtroom with his dad over in Jacksonville when I worked over there sometimes, probably with the Marshal Service and then with the state too. But his father, Lacey Mahan, was well known. It was a very... had much, what would the word I use? Never seen a lawyer like him in the courtroom, much prowess in the courtroom. Is that a good word, prowess, to
yes,
describe
sir.
Him? But one thing I did always like about him, if we ever had a moment to sit, he loved Jacksonville. He was always a big promoter of Jacksonville, and I know he was a friend and a confidant of many mayors over there. So we are honored to have you here today and the history that your family has and what you've done. I know you got appointed circuit judge about 2007.
Yes, sir. That's accurate.
And then as selected to be chief judge since about 8 years ago. So welcome, Chief Judge Mark Mahan of the 4th Judicial District. If you don't know where that is Jacksonville, Duval County, also Nassau County, which is Fernandina, Yulee and Callahan and Clay County,
yes, sir.
Orange Park, Fleming Island, and Green Coast City. So we're honored to have you here, and you're welcome to begin.
All right. Thank you, sir. And frankly, the honor is mine to be here and to be able to present. By way of background, I was going to give you a little bit of introduction, but your chair, I think, cut out for the first couple of minutes of my speech, but I am here on behalf.
I did a pretty good job at it.
Yes, sir. You did an amazing job. Thank you so much. And Chair Brannon was involved in a case back when I did criminal defense work, and an innocent individual was apprehended, and truth will out. But anyway, a different story. But it's an honor and a pleasure to be here this afternoon, and this morning, I'm sorry, on behalf of the Trial Court Budget Commission. I have been involved with the Trial Court Budget Commission for about 15 years since being appointed as a judge. The Trial Court Budget Commission is a statutory and legislative creation, and our responsibility is to recommend to the branch, to the Supreme Court, the budget needs for the state court system, and also to go over here and ask for those needs as recognized by the Supreme Court in the form of legislative budget requests to help the court system run and to meet our needs and meet the needs of the citizens that you represent. One of those needs is the pandemic recovery plan. And that's the source of the presentation today. We're continuing our legislative budget request for year three of the pandemic recovery plan. The history is, of course, what everyone knows, which is back in March of 2020, the state and the world kind of stopped and paused with the outbreak of the pandemic. And abruptly, the way that the courts do business changed literally overnight. Our work and our function up until that time was primarily face-to-face. In other words, you know, people came in, witnesses, lawyers, jurors, litigants, they all came into the court system and presented their case and were heard. And it was very much an in-person business. And again, kind of, you know, immediately and on a dime, we went from in-person to not being able to do in-person. And so we had to rethink the functions and the way that we conducted our business. And that created what we have referred to as the backlog. The court system stayed open during this period of time throughout, and we continued to do cases and to try cases. But our ability to function was significantly impacted, and it created a backlog of cases as a result of that. And the backlog we saw, and we began with estimates, the backlog that we saw consisted primarily of three different areas. First, there were cases that were delayed. That is, cases that were already filed, that were already proceeding, and that they had to be paused. And probably the most dramatic evidence of this is the fact that speedy trial was paused during that period of time. And for those of you that don't know and are not familiar with criminal courts, speedy trial is basically the right to be tried within, on a misdemeanor to be tried within 3 months, and on a felony to be tried within 6 months of the date of your arrest. And the Supreme Court did what I think was kind of the unprecedented move of trying of just saying that the rights of speedy trial was suspended during that period of time because we just were struggling to get jurors, to get witnesses, to get cases to trial and get cases going. And again, I'm not aware of that occurring any time in the state of Florida's past, but there were these delayed proceedings, and then there were civil proceedings, and that was due to experts, witnesses, lawyers, people being unable to fly, people being afraid to travel, compromised attorneys, and all different varieties of problems, delayed all these proceedings that were existing in the pipeline. And so that was the first part of what we saw as our backlog. The second part that we saw was delayed filings. And we looked at the history of what cases were being filed in small claims, in civil, in criminal cases. And those all of a sudden were not filed. And we knew that they were going to come out at some point in time in many of those circumstances. And so there was a delayed filings component of those. And the final part of the backlog that we anticipated seeing was the cases that were related to the litigation or the pandemic itself, and that might be the financial hardships that were created by the pandemic, the litigation and people suing other people in disputes and disagreements about contracts, about labor, about those types of things, and that is new cases that were generated just by the pandemic themselves. So those three components, that is the delayed proceedings, the paused proceedings, for lack of a better term, and the new proceedings, created this backlog. And they constituted what we thought to be about two-thirds then of the existing cases that we had. And we looked at our estimate, and that's shown on the chart in front of you. The estimate shows that at that time, when we looked in year one of our ask, we estimated the backlog to be about 1 million cases, just short of 1 million cases. And so we'd come to the legislature and ask for a pandemic recovery plan. Now, this plan consists primarily of short-term or temporary resources. The court system had a history of being able to, and something we could lean on, and back in 2007, we had the foreclosure crisis. And that led to a large number of cases being in the system, an unexpectedly large number of cases being in the system as a result of a single event that was unanticipated. And we leaned on some of the experience and some of the knowledge that we had gained during that period of time. And that consists primarily, this pandemic recovery plan consisted primarily of short-term resources. And that is, number one, senior judges, which are retired judges that are again certified and able to come in and hear the cases as if they were regular judges, but they're paid only for day labor, as it might be. So you hired the senior judge for a day here and there to come in and get rid of that backlog. We also knew we needed case managers, that is, people that would proactively try to go into the cases and try to see what you could do to try to move those cases and the resources that were needed. We needed temporary magistrates, we needed staff attorneys, and other OPS services, that is, other personnel services that were not going to stay a permanent employee of the branch. And we had asked for, as you see again on the chart, we had asked for $12 million in non-recurring revenue in year one. The appropriation that the legislature then gave to the court system was about $9.5 million in non-recurring. We had asked for general revenue non-recurring, and the legislature at that time appropriated money from our state court revenue trust fund, which was healthy enough at that time to be able to financially fund that. And so that, as you can see, the progress that we made from year one to year two in reducing that backlog was about almost a million cases down to about 709,000. Again, last year, the legislature, we came back in with the same last ask, and the legislature appropriated year two funds in that. Again, our ask was similar, really $10 million in, again, non-recurring general revenue, and we again were appropriated money from the state court trust system to the dollar of our ask. We now stand in the middle of year two in terms of our numbers, and we show at December 31st of 2020, the most recent numbers we have on filings, show that we are making significant progress in reducing the backload, this backlog of cases, and we're coming in again for our final ask for year three for these same types of resources, the magistrates, the hearing officers, the staff attorneys, to be done in OPS, not permanent full-time employees, and also senior judge money. And with that, we hope that we will be able to get this backlog eliminated. We're not certain that we'll be able to do that because so much of the environment has changed, but we're asking for your consideration in that. We struggle, as of course everyone has since the pandemic, of hiring, and that continues to be an issue, to be able to hire some of the positions that we have, and it's further exacerbated by some of the fact that our hiring is OPS. They're not people that are going to be permanent FTE employees. So some of those people and some of those positions we've not been able to hire. That's the bad news. But the good news is we're making significant progress on this backlog. I've always said that, and haven't done this before, I think that a capable, functioning court system is an infrastructure need that the citizens deserve, just like any other, just like electricity and roads and those types of things. That is a court system that's able to effectively and efficiently adjudicate issues and is responsive to business disputes, is responsible for personal disputes, domestic violence, all the different types of things that you see in the emergencies. And leaving that on the back burner to chance in our view is not a wise thing. And we hope that you would continue with year three funding of the pandemic recovery plan. And I think that's my presentation. If there are any questions that anyone might have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for your presentation. My quick question is, you said that it's not certain that the backlog will be completed in this year three. Do you know how long you see or project that it will take for the backlog to be completed?
And through the chair, we are optimistic that we will be able to make progress and make significant impact on that. One of the things that we've discovered is that some of the cases that we've resolved might have been more low-hanging fruit. That is, the cases that were easier, that were less complex. For example, in Duval County, I've got a construction litigation case that one of the judges has, and it's got 25 or 30 defendants. That case has been out there for a long time because of the fact that you just need an incredible number of jurors. You need the resources. You need to have enough jurors that are willing to come in and handle that. And you need probably 3 or 4 months of calendar time. It's very difficult to get that case resolved and move that to the front of the queue without that. So, again, we think we've done some of the easier work in terms of resolving the backlog, but we're optimistic that with the correct resources, we'll be able to get this backlog done and taken care of.
Thank you, Chair. Just in looking at the slide where you have TBD under the appropriation for the third year of the recovery plan, my question goes to the health of the trust fund itself. Would In your opinion, would it be more appropriate for us to take money out of the trust fund, which would be $34 million over 3 years, or take it out of general revenue?
Through the chair, the years one and two, years two have already been appropriated and done by prior legislatures. So the money that we're looking for at this time is the $11 million. And I'm glad you said that, because that was one of the points that I was supposed to make earlier in my presentation is, there's a real strong belief that our trust fund, that state court revenue trust fund, is not capable of sustaining that. And of course, we're optimistic that we'll be able to get, if the money is received, that we'll be able to spend that money and get the backlog resolved. We would remind you that it is non-recurring money. We're asking for non-recurring general revenue. So of course, if it's not spent and we're not able to get the results that we want, that money would come back to the legislature. So it's one time. But our ask is that it be in non-recurring GR.
Thank you, Rep. Smith. Representative Gottlieb, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Your Honor, thank you for coming and addressing us today. One of the things that I keep saying year in and year out here is one of the deficiencies that I see in the judicial system. For instance, I have court costs on a felony third-degree case in Escambia County. I'm about to resolve it. Case will be approximately 5 months old. The court costs are $870. In civil cases, by comparison, I think for one civil case, the court cost is $400. And I wonder if you know, when was the last time that was addressed or increased? I think by today's standards, it could. Not that I'm trying to discourage anybody from access to courts. But is that something that would help us fund the court system if we found an appropriate number for a civil filing fee?
Through the chair. And thank you for that question. Of course, the court system is always defers to the wisdom of the legislature in terms of the fines, fees, and costs. There is a concern of access to courts that we always struggle with. And most of the fines and fees and costs go to the clerk, and then they're divided up with any number of people that receive those monies. The court system does not receive a great deal of that money. The money goes into the state court revenue trust fund, which is where this money came from. The reluctance of the court system to fund on the back of that is there's an appearance that the judges are funding their, putting money in their own pockets, or funding their own money if it comes through fines, fees, and costs. So we just kind of try to present the needs and let the legislature in their wisdom decide where that money ought to be received from. The clerks, again, are much more cognizant of where all those monies are divided up. But that may be appropriate that the civil, because typically in civil arenas they have more funds. There's so many felony fines, fees, and costs that are not collected at the end of the day.
Thank you to Representative Gottlieb for that question. We'll now move to Representative Waldron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple quick questions. One is just worst case scenario, and you didn't get any funding, what would that do to the pending cases above normal? How would that happen?
Through the chair, there's a concern that, and of course these cases aren't necessarily identified as saying this is a case that falls into that category. It's just a larger pile of cases. So it would, unfortunately, it would probably slow down the system. Slow down the administration of justice. There's so many impacts with cases that you're not able to resolve. It causes witnesses, it causes lawyers, it causes the sheriff's office, it causes jail impacts in criminal cases. The jail population increases. There's the lack of recollection of witnesses in those types of matters. So we feel like it's a very negative impact, and it's a due process issue as we see it.
Thank you. If I may ask one more question,
yes, ma'am.
I think you mentioned that you struggle, without a doubt, to get more temporary hiring, right? But do you have any thoughts on what might entice people to come? What could be done to get more temporary people in to help with that caseload?
Through the chair. And I think you'll hear from everyone that during this session that hiring continues to be a struggle. There's so many other people now that look at different values. I mean, again, 5 years ago, it was you got dressed, you went, you came into work, you got a parking place, you paid for your lunch, and now a lot of that has changed. And so we're struggling in some circumstances to try to find employees that are willing to come. Again, a lot of these still require in-person work. The magistrates, the senior judges, even some of the case managers, they require a lot of interaction. So we think that money always is one of those things at the end of the day. But it again, like everyone else in the state system, I think you'll find, and maybe really throughout private practice, in the private world, you'll still find people that are running into difficulties with hiring. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Waldron, for these questions. We'll now go to Representative Valdez. Recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chief Judge Mahone, for your presentation this morning. My question to you is, should this appropriation be awarded, how will you be able to sustain the workload moving forward?
Again, through the chair, we would like to try to direct these additional resources at resolving as many cases as we can until we get back to a normal circumstance. Senior judges have proven in our circumstances to be invaluable. Law clerks to help move the civil cases is something that have helped us a great deal. Case managers looking at those cases. Again, we don't want those to become full-time employees. We would love to have the full-time employees, but recognize it in responsibility. Once we get, I like to call it the mouse and the snake. Once we get the mouse and the snake through the snake, that hopefully we'll get back more normal operations. We've shown good success with this money in reducing the caseload. And so we're optimistic that we will be able to find these people, fund it, and if funded, spend the money appropriately and get our case operations maybe a little bit more back to normal.
Olive.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So based on your description, I'm wondering if it wouldn't be wise to see about making some of these positions, because my question really refers to how has the caseload compared today's data versus several years ago? It seems that there are going to be more cases, therefore putting more of a strain on the system, and it might be something to look further ahead if we are charging more Floridians with crimes and they're going through the system, then I just wonder what that data looks like from compared to several years ago to what it is today.
And thank you for the question. We continue to evaluate the cases, and some of the results we have seen were a little bit unexpected. For example, for some reason, probate cases are up higher than they were in the past. Small claims cases filings have gone up a great deal, and maybe it's because of credit cards and other debts and things that are out there in the pipeline. The difficulty always in looking at the future is you never know what the economic environment's going to be, and that always changes. I think that there was a thought that the economic environment was going to be more negatively impacted in Florida, but it is not in some circumstances. The population continues to grow, and frankly, the legislature themselves makes some changes in laws that change some of our workload. The jurisdictional increase in county court is going through where county court jurisdiction for small claims is going through. So there are a lot of other factors that influence it, and we're doing the best we can to try to narrow out and point to those increases that are due to the pandemic and its results, as opposed to some of those other factors. So.
Thank you, Representative Valdez. We'll now go to Representative Beltran for a question.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you, Judge, for your presentation and certainly for this information and your efforts to mitigate the backlog due to COVID. But I want to ask you about DACA congestion more generally, because certainly the beginning of COVID or the era of COVID, I hope that's over, but in any event, we had DACA congestion before COVID. In trial courts, particularly in the civil dockets, it's sometimes difficult to get a hearing. It's difficult for the judges to prepare for the hearings due to the caseload. Every year I've been in the legislature, I think except my first year, we have implemented the Supreme Court's recommendation on increasing judges across the board. So I guess my question is, do we still need more circuit court judges? Do we need law clerks? Do we need magistrates? What can we do to, increase the efficiency of the court system as a next step, separate and apart from what we've been doing for COVID?
Through the chair. Representative, if you remember, the Supreme Courts are my bosses, so I'm not going to sit up here and say anything about their recommendations or their certification needs or those types of things. On the ground, we feel some of that pressure. We're in the middle just beginning a workload study. We had a study that was done, and again, it was during a period of time when I was on the Trial Court Budget Commission, but we had a study that was instituted a time study where the judges basically filled out timesheets to try to figure out how much time each case or each court event took, and then multiply that time by the number of cases that you have. And again, our old study was pre-pandemic and really kind of stale and outdated. Because of the staleness of that, I think that the branch is going forward with a time study. I think there was some concern about has the practice of law in the world kind of returned to normal enough for us to do that study? But the study is needs to be redone. So that's going to start in the spring. So in several months, we'll be working on that. The thing that I do know is that we're always, the state of Florida, and it's something that we're very proud of as judges, we're always in the top, I want to say five, maybe 10, but usually in the top five in terms of efficiency, which is the number of judges we have per 100,000 citizens. Again, for a growing, complex state like Florida, I think it's something that we're very proud of. And those are trial judges. And that's the best metric that we have. That comes from the National Center for State Courts. So we feel like the judges are busy and there's a lot of work out there. Some of the changes that have been suggested to the civil practice might impact some of the judges' caseload to that. But right now it's a busy time, and it's been made more busy by some of the backlog in the criminal cases and having to divert resources to that and the due process needs. But I know the Supreme Court just recently did a certification opinion, and I think that there were maybe one or two judges that were recommended. So I think we're just kind of holding our breath until we get the results of that new study and may come to the legislature. They may come to the legislature and ask that other judges be added.
Thank you, Rep. Beltran. We'll now move to Representative Fernandez-Barquin. Recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thank Your Honor for coming. And something, this is just a comment that I want to address the rest of the committee on how critical and how important case managers and these senior retired judges are. And I saw it firsthand in Miami-Dade County in probate court that they're able to bring in a retired judge to just handle an overflow of cases, right? And in addition to that, they have case managers. And what the case managers do is essentially make sure the paperwork is in line and that essentially the case is ripe for it to go in front of the judge and to make sure all the essential paperwork is there so that everything can just can operate smoothly. Your Honor, if there's anything else you want to chime in as to the description of those, I just want them to understand they're unsung heroes when it comes to the overflow of cases.
And I would cede my time to the representative. He was doing a great job.
Your Honor.
If I might ask, what is the daily rate for a senior judge?
The daily rate is $500.
$500. And it's been that for how long?
It was increased, I want to say, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. It was $375 previously. If I may, through the chair, the problem with senior judges is, number one, they are senior. They are typically 70 or plus. And they do have other opportunities in mediation or return to private practice. So we had adjusted that rate not that long ago. Some areas are experiencing a shortage of senior judges. Some areas have more. I've been a judge for 15 years, and I'm the third most senior judge in Duval County in the Fourth Circuit. So there are more senior judges. There was a large number of judges that were there, and then they retired. So we have more senior judges and fewer judges that are as aged as mine. In some areas, they just can't find senior judges. It's again, they have health issues. They're impacted by COVID. Some of them felt reluctant to come in person proceedings. And so in some areas, that's been a problem, is being able to get those. But they are a very, very important resource.
Thank you. Representative Fabrizio, recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Your Honor, thank you so much for a wonderful presentation. I remember your presentation last year, and again, you've done incredibly well. My question has to do with the change in the jurisdictional amount that we saw for county court and circuit court. And you mentioned earlier that you've seen a heightened, and if I misheard you, please clarify, that you've seen heightened filings in the county courts. I would conclude that would be likely to some degree because of the jurisdictional changes. What has the impact, as far as you've seen in the circuit courts, with that jurisdictional amount change?
Through the chair, the county court cases are there in more significant numbers. The other thing that I have seen, and this is from not from speaking for necessarily for the branch or for other judges, but from my impact, it's a little bit changed some of the work of the county court judges, because a lot of the county court judges' work previously was self-represented. And now all of a sudden, when you're getting to $75,000 and you're going to have more insurance agencies, more complex litigation, typically a county court trial in the past was a day, with a jury trial or with a non-jury trial. That may not be the norm anymore. That has not yet, I don't know how many years we've got out before that gets fully involved, but it's, I think, kind of fundamentally changed the structure of the way they do business, and they're having to rethink that. Where if you thought, you had a trial and you could set it and resolve it in a day, all of a sudden a county court trial, small claims trial, may take 2 or 3 days, and that just means the other cases kind of go begging. Most of my judges run, and I say my judges in Duval, they might run 1,500 to 3,000 county court cases, county court civil cases at any one time. So there's a lot of cases that are coming through there.
Yes.
And so the impact, I would imagine, would be if there is an increase because of the jurisdictional amount increase at the county court level, would there be an equivalent decrease at the circuit court level?
Through the chair, I don't know if that's necessarily, we've necessarily seen that as much. These cases were again, the low-hanging fruit kind of the circuit level. They were typically more cases that were capable of being resolved. I don't know that the issue or the court hearing itself is changed as much as county court, I don't think, was necessarily geared for this as much. They don't have the number of case managers. They don't have staff attorneys. And I'll just use this as an example. The federal court judges, I think they have 2 staff attorneys and a magistrate per judge. We have 3 judges per staff attorney. And those are allocated to the circuits, and they're split up any way they might be. In Duval, for example, I don't have the ability to allow a staff attorney to work on a county court case. I just don't have the, because of the numbers and because of the volume. And a lot of the staff attorney's work is on 3.850s and 3.851s, which are felony or criminal post-conviction work. And so the county court judges now are in a situation where the stakes are higher, the cases are more complicated, and they just really don't have the resources to get a staff attorney at their hand. The good thing about this is in unrepresented cases, typically, they were, again, smaller alligators, for lack of a better term. In these more complex cases, you do have lawyers, so you can lean on them to ask to prepare orders or to write briefs or those types of things. But I don't yet know that we've seen all the significance in the workload as to how it's going to affect county court. Circuit court civil always needs more hearing time, as the representative said earlier. And that as much as you can free up those judges, it's working the way you would like to versus working the way you have to. Right now, we have to do what we've got to do, and would like to, would be to have more time and again, more resources to devote to these cases.
Thank you so much. And with regard to some of the things that came out of COVID that may have been silver linings, such as motion calendar hearings via Zoom, has some circuits have continued that practice. Has there been a positive effect for moving cases forward with continuing that as prior to COVID where we didn't have that?
Through the chair. Absolutely. And I think, for example, family law is an area that they have found that they're able to make a great deal of progress. It used to be that lawyers would come down to court for a five-minute set, that is to set the case for a final hearing. And I don't think anyone trusted the technology. And a lot of lawyers were reluctant to go down. If the other lawyer was appearing in person, they wanted to be there in person as well. And there was a mistrust of the technology, that they wouldn't get cut off or get shortchanged from that. But now with Zoom, and it frankly taught everyone, it taught judges who weren't necessarily Zoom experts, it taught them how to do it. And I think there's been a great deal of efficiency. The benefit of that is that money is saved to the client, where you used to bill the client 2 hours to do a five-minute hearing. Now you can bill them reasonably on that. So there certainly are efficiencies that have occurred. And that, again, is a little bit dependent on state in circuit-to-circuit resources and what they're able to do and what's comfortable in doing. Some cases still need to be in person, frankly. And of course, criminal is one of them. I think that's very important. We, in Duval, we did a totally remote jury trial from start to finish, and that was from selecting the jurors. They saw the witnesses, and they all were remote. We had jurors that went down to the public library to be able to be qualified, and this was not just jury selection, but from jury selection all the way through deliberation. It was very labor-intensive in trying to do that. We had to have case managers there with them. We had to have staff attorneys. We had to make sure that the bailiffs, which used to let people in physically, we had to have bailiffs that let people in remotely, so it required a different skill set. I don't know if the juice was worth the squeeze in that circumstance, but there's a lot that the court system learned with regard to that.
Right, and I agree wholeheartedly, and that's why I mentioned that while motion calendar, I think, is phenomenal for exactly all the reasons that you mentioned, but an online Zoom jury trial, I think, would be fraught with peril. Which I think you outlined. Thank you so much, Your Honor.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you for the questions. Representative Bracey Davis, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning. Thank you for that presentation. So I want to go back to the pre-pandemic backlog for a moment. And I'm looking at the three-year appropriation ask. And how confident are you that if this last prong of the three-year plan is funded, that we can, this is the fix? How confident are you that this is a kind of barring not another pandemic, a one-time kind of non-precedent setting ask and fulfilling of a need?
Through the chair, thank you. We feel relatively certain that we will make significant progress with regard to this. I can't sit here and guarantee. Again, there's so many things that have emerged that, again, were kind of so unexpected. I mean, I looked back, and again, being chief and being over here advocating 3 years ago in year one, when we had that, we thought this was going to be a six-month phenomena. And everybody did. You know, they thought, well, the virus gets here, and then it goes, and everything's back where it is, and system returns. The housing market, the labor market, the economic influences, again, changes by the legislature in underlying statutes, all of those things affect our workload and affect what might happen. But we just feel like without this ask again in year three of this, we're going to be losing ground. And so far, as you can see from our trend of getting rid of the backlog, we've had a great deal of success. We hope that this will be the last, but can I sit there and say it will not be? I really can't do that. And having been up here 15 years, y'all can beat up on me. If I'm still appointed by the Chief Justice to come over here and advocate, y'all can beat up on me next year if we don't get there.
Members, any other questions? Representative Campbell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one final question. I know pandemics are difficult to kind of foresee, but are you guys preparing for future pandemics or trying to hire more or have more of a preventative measure in place so that this doesn't really happen again, where we fall with a shortage of judges and services and OPS that is needed?
Through the chair. I'm termed out as chief judge, so I will be so glad that the next chief judge in Duval that has this problem is not me. But yet we feel like every time we go through this, and again, we're leaning a little bit on our experience from the mortgage foreclosure crisis, which was, and again, not to be respectful of your time, but the mortgage foreclosure crisis was a situation where everyone's house was foreclosed and the plaintiffs weren't pushing the cases because they didn't want the house to be sold at a bad time, and they didn't want to have that house or that property put on their books at a lower value, and the person that owned the house didn't want to be foreclosed on, so those cases were just sitting there. And at the time, the Wall Street Journal wrote negatively about the work of, about the legislative structure of the and the statutory structure of our court system. So we had to go in and actually start pushing those cases. So every time we go through a situation where we have something unexpected. And, you know, something I forgot to mention, we had the hurricane that hit the Southwest in the middle of all of this. And those types of events occur. The good thing is the legislature has always been responsive to our needs and always helped us through this. And again, we hope that's the case. But I hope it's not a pandemic. I don't know what it might be that causes the next crisis. But we hope we're ready to respond and be able to do that. Again, we're very proud of the progress we've made.
Anyone else? Seeing no one, well, thank you, Chief Judge. We appreciate your breadth of knowledge and your expertise.
Thank you, Mr.
Coming,
Chair.
And the Supreme Court made a fine selection in choosing you.
Well, thank you.
Thank
you. I appreciate
making
it.
Making a trip from Jacksonville today.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
And I will rib him as he leaves the podium. That innocent individual that he represented that I happened to arrest was found guilty by a jury of his peers.
Well, we didn't need to say that part, did we? No, as they say in the Catskills, I'll be here all week. So anyway,
thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Secretary Dixon, you're next. Let's welcome the Secretary of the Department of Corrections. He testified before the Criminal Justice Policy Committee that I was chairman of last year, and he was Deputy Secretary. So I'm proud to introduce you this morning as Secretary of the Department of Corrections. Welcome, Secretary Ricky Dixon. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir. Good morning, Chair Brandon, Vice Chair Smith, Ranking Member Valdez, and members of the committee. I really appreciate the opportunity to update you on what is the department's most critical issue, and that's the recruitment and retention of correctional officers statewide. I can say it's good to see familiar faces here. So many of you frequent our prisons in an effort to help and or have had me over in the office and us to discuss issues and challenges facing our agency and on the phone with several of you as well. So thank you for your interest in helping our system recover. Thank you for that. So briefly, the slide above outlines the mission of the Florida Department of Corrections and our purpose. Simply put, I know you're well aware that the public safety mission is to incarcerate Florida's inmate population and to supervise offenders placed on court-ordered supervision. However, I would argue that our public safety mission goes far beyond just the time these individuals are in our custody. We pride ourselves on protecting the public, and that has to do also with the time that they are released from, after they're released from our system, ensuring that we provided them the resources to be successful. You know, doing that not only reduces future taxpayer burdens on Floridians in terms of taxes, but there's always a victim usually associated with that return to prison. So we want to make sure we do a good job during the time they're with us. Doing that as well, there's an immediate benefit. There's a reduction in inmate idleness, which is so closely associated with a reduction in violence. So that's why we're advocating so strongly for inmate programs and vocational and education type programs, not only to help with that long-term reentry, but for an immediate resolution of the amount of idleness that we're experiencing. So as you know, we are the largest state agency by personnel in Florida, and the work we do is extremely staff intensive. The next slide is just simply a visual representation of the architecture of our system. FDC's purpose, safe communities, safe prisons, and the pillars it takes for us to accomplish those critical requirements are staffing, programming, and obviously infrastructure and equipment needs. Essential to everything we do is the hardworking men and women of this agency. And I don't ever want to miss the opportunity to recognize the outstanding and remarkable work they do in some very, very dangerous environments. A year and a half ago, as the chair mentioned, I was standing before a committee explaining the just the challenges they're facing. They still are, but we're moving in such a better direction right now because of your action and the hard work and them seeing us through these difficult times. So I really appreciate the work they do. Taking a closer look at our staff breakdown, this slide just details the number of FTE assigned to each of our major sections and the training we are required to provide staff that hold the certifications. I do want to point out those numbers you see are not representative of total FTE. That's just representative of those that are filled right now, those positions that currently have a certified officer in them in each of their respective categories there. So like many other agencies and businesses, recruitment of qualified applicants and the retention of employees has been very challenging in recent years. And we have significant vacancies, not just in correctional officers, but in other areas as well, such as maintenance, education, probation officers. And we need to address all of these issues together. I will say again, because of your actions last session, we are seeing a tremendous positive momentum like I haven't seen in years. I haven't seen the morale and the momentum and the drive we have in a number of years, and it's a direct result of your support last year, so thank you for that. In November of 2021, we had 43 out of 50 correctional institutions with a vacancy rate above 10%. A number were operating at 30 to 40%, and in some cases even as high as 50%. Our staffing levels were rapidly deteriorating because of the mandatory overtime, causing just unsustainable and poor working conditions. We asked you for your immediate support, and you answered, and you can see the positive results in that right column, how we're trending in the right direction now for the first time in a long time, bringing down these institutions that are over 10%. In January, as you know, we had LBC action that took the pay up from 33.5 to 38.750. Subsequent to that, during the legislative session, with your approval, we took the pay to $41,600, which is $20 an hour, and that had paid tremendous dividends there. Now, we continue to offer the $1,000 hiring bonus at institutions with a vacancy rate of 10% or greater. Another large part of the pay plan last year that we want to do again this year is that recognition of tenure, the increase at the 2-year, 5-year, and 8-year marks. Those are the key points where we lose a lot of staff. So if we can offer an incentive in pay at those marks, that's going to be significant. So much of the outcry, and it's understandable with officers across the state, is you take a 10-year veteran and he says, well, I'm making the same thing as somebody walking in the door today. And certainly that's not the kind of pay scale that we want to operate. So this addresses that at the 2-year, 5-year, and 8-year mark. Again, can't thank those senior officers enough that did stay with us and got us through. And thank you for not leaving us behind or leaving them behind. You will see our request to continue these increases again this year, as I've stated. Because of the pay increase for correctional officers, the department staffing, as you see on this slide, was in an absolute free fall. That's very representative of what we were dealing with in staffing, just an absolute free fall. In the 18 months prior to December, to the December pay increase, we sustained a net loss of 2,400 officers. Since the action taken by this body and ongoing support from Governor DeSantis, we have begun to rebound, as you see on the right side of that slide. We're now hiring and retaining more staff than we were losing. We've increased our correctional officer class by more than 1,100 over the past several months. However, the climb has started to slow recently, and there's several factors that can be attributed to that. One is the holidays. That's typical during October, November, December. Hiring slows, and we did experience that, unfortunately. And then also in just certain geographical areas of our state, we're still competing with local law enforcement facilities and other employers and competitors in certain areas. So we do have a number of facilities that aren't rebounding as fast as the system is as a whole, probably about 10 or 12 facilities that we're struggling with. We do continue to be optimistic, though, about the overall trajectory, and we know our momentum needs to continue to hire these 3,000 vacancies that we still have in our system. It's a lot better than it was last time I stood before you, but still 3,000 is a large number to overcome, and the people having to overcome it are those officers that are there in the prisons working a tremendous amount of overtime every day to get us through. So the next slide, you asked about the 8.5-hour shifts. I want to thank you for that, for the authority to finish that conversion. It's increased continuity, unbelievably, increased communication. It's true that there are certain officers that individually do not prefer that shift over a 12-hour shift, but a system as a whole operates and functions much better. We're able to pay them for the walk time. We're able to communicate with them prior to shift, have a shift briefing now that we didn't have before. You know, you may know a lot of our housing units do not have fiber. We don't have computers. We don't have email. in those housing units. So communicating with 24,000 staff is remarkably difficult. So having the ability for this shift briefing is was a tremendous benefit, and as well as just the consistency of operations and the overall improvements. They update on the National Guard. I can tell you that has been a tremendous success. And I will pause a minute and give credit to the leadership in the Florida National Guard. What a professional organization. And they didn't go about this lightly. Their leadership, along with the leadership of the Florida Department of Corrections, we went over to Camp Blanding. We put a considerable amount of time in planning that transition and onboarding those staff, and it has been nothing but successful. As you know, we have about 300 now in a total of 9 prisons. Those prisons are listed on screen. And it may appear that, well, that just helped the 9 prisons. Well, it actually assisted the agency as a whole, because we were able to concentrate our growth in the inmate population there at those facilities and not spread it out to other facilities across Florida. So even though they're in 9, the impact they're making is statewide. And finally, in closing, I said it last year, and it's so true that we often overcomplicate the solutions to cause the system to recover. It's not nearly as complicated as we often make it. We've got to do 3 things. We've got to further handle the staffing issues. We have to address that, and we do that by furthering the pay initiatives. That's working, and I would argue if something's working, we do more of it, so we need to continue with that. The programming and resources, for the reasons I described, not just the long-term benefits, but that immediate benefit of reducing inmate idleness, making our prisons safer, and by doing that, we help recruitment, because it's a safer place to work, and it's a safer place to live for those who are in our custody. And then finally, we must continue to fund the infrastructure and the equipment needs throughout our agency. And we've got a good start last year, but we have to continue to do that. We've got a lot of aging facilities, aging fleet, aging IT infrastructure that we need to continue to move in the right direction. So thank you again for your support. That's the presentation. That's a brief update of those items that I was asked for, and I'd be glad to take any questions.
Thank you, Secretary Dixon. Members, do we have any questions for the Secretary? Representative Snyder?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Secretary, great to see you again. And just before I get into my question, just want to start by saying thank you to the men and women who serve in our Department of Corrections. We know it's a critical part of the entire public safety equation, and great to hear the positive trend on the recruitment and retention front, but look forward to exploring additional solutions in that realm. You know, as the last couple of years, taking the opportunity to get to know, you know, exactly how our prisons function and operate, and realizing just some of the differences, really, with our state and contracted facilities. One of the things I was curious about was kind of something I did not know was that our contracted prisons are currently overseen by DMS as opposed to the Department of Corrections. I was just curious. From your perspective, if you had any insight on, you know, if now would be a good time to bring that over under your purview, or just what your current thoughts are from boots on the ground.
Sure, Mr. Chair.
Recognize.
Yes, it's not uncommon at all for the private prisons in other states to be operated by the prison system itself. So that kind of allows you to operate as one system. And I would say there are significant operational benefits to that kind of model. That is accurate.
Senator Fabricio, you recognize.
Thank you, Secretary. Excellent presentation. I've had the opportunity with some of my colleagues to visit Everglades Correctional Facility a couple of times, and I was happy to see that the increase in the retention of the corrections officers is making a positive impact. My question is with regard to the National Guard. And you may have mentioned it, and I apologize if I didn't catch it. How many troops have been deployed by the Florida National Guard?
There's 300 total guard members.
And what's the anticipated, and I follow up, thank you. What's the anticipated length of that deployment?
Mr. Chair, it's scheduled through June 30th of this year. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Representative Bracy Davis, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for this presentation. I see one of the priorities is funding for equipment. I'd like you to talk a little bit about the air conditioning and the heating. I had the opportunity to visit Marion a couple weeks ago, and it is my understanding, of course, that there is no air conditioning, there's no heating. We know that we've had some really, really cool days, and I'm sure in the summer there are some really hot days. It's also my understanding that in other prisons around the country, there are portable air conditioned units that are in different prisons. Just want to hear your thoughts as you're asking for funding for equipment. Do you have any thoughts on those portable heating and cooling apparatuses?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I think we all agree that it's a conditions impact behavior. And these facilities, these newer facilities that we have that do have some type of air condition, whether it be geothermal units or whatever it may be, that it improves operations for our staff and the population alike. So we're in favor of that. I think the debate is how do we get there? Some of the push we receive is it's just cost prohibitive to go into some of these old, inefficiently designed buildings and retro air. So that brings up your question about the portable units. We are piloting this coming summer two, maybe three different types of units to see if something is a temporary fix. There is some humidity issues attributed to some of those portable units. So before we spend a lot of the state's money and realize that we went too far and they're not effective, we want to go on a small scale and pilot them. But the right answer is to continue to study where our system needs to be in the future as we look at prison modernization. It's why I'm so glad that we're doing the prison modernization study to not only determine where do we need to be 2 years from now, but 5, 10, and 20. So certainly as we build new construction, it'll have those considerations in play.
Representative Valdez, you're recognized.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, if I may be recognized for a series of questions. Thank you. Secretary Dixon, thank you for your presentation today. And I really like the mission, especially where we're saying that we're talking about that we're creating a safe and professional environment with the outcome of reduced victimization. That is important. And it's also victimization within the compound itself. And I hope that is also reiterated. My question comes up. You talked a little bit about the housing, not having the infrastructure as far as wireless connectivity. Is that where the officers reside? I was confused about that.
Mr. Chair, it is. It is. A lot of our housing units don't have that the fiber and the wiring down there for the computer systems.
So my question is, with our initiative of accessing broadband, why hasn't that been a priority? That's above our pay grade, I'm sure. But if that's, I don't know why we haven't prioritized those housing units.
Mr. Chair, we are this year, we have a very aggressive request. I do the presentation in front of the Budget Committee tomorrow, and we're trying to address that, not just for the inmate population, but for the staff population as well. A couple different strategies or ways to get there. But we're going to make an aggressive push this year to correct that. It's expensive, but we know we need to do it. We also know we need to tailor everything we do to the study that's going on to make sure we don't invest in infrastructure locations that may be shifted or closed. So we're working through all those challenges right now. But I agree, we need to address that in some manner.
And the year 2023, that's so antiquated for me that it's mind-blowing. Follow-up question. In reference to your priorities list. So I get the pay initiatives. Can you remind me what is it that you need in order to become an employee of the Department of Corrections? What is the minimum criteria? Thank you. The minimum criteria to become an officer.
Sure. Mr. Chair, you have to have a high school diploma or its equivalent. You have to meet certain standards in terms of the background check that we place everyone through. And then there's certain physical requirements and things like that, a drug test and an array of items you have to meet to be employed.
And in reference to that background check, what does that entail? Can one be employed as an officer having been arrested, having had a misdemeanor, a felony? Is what does that background check entail?
Sure, through the chair. It's multifaceted. An arrest doesn't necessarily in and of itself exclude you from employment, especially a misdemeanor arrest. lot of factors are taken into consideration. Now, felonies would exclude you. Misdemeanors would depend on the time span that has gone on from the time of the arrest, the circumstances of the arrest, the type of arrest, the type of criminal background. But just a misdemeanor in and of itself that may have occurred 7 or 10 years ago, depending on the behavior since that time, wouldn't necessarily exclude you.
Okay. Follow-up, sir? Thank you. In reference to the programming resources, that's something that I believe that is really lacking in the system, especially if we're trying to correct behaviors, hence the facilities, names of our correctional facilities. So what has been the challenge of getting these educational opportunities, primarily GED, trades, and things of that nature to prepare these individuals to become productive citizens? What are some of the challenges that you are facing, and how can we assist with those?
Mr. Chair, sure, great question. The challenge is scalability. I think we have many programs throughout the state that we can brag about, and we should, and be proud of, that are remarkable. And those few inmates that get access to those programs do remarkably well. The problem is we're a large system, 83,000 in our system right now. So I guess the challenge is sheer numbers. It's not space. We have space throughout our system, education buildings, vocational buildings to accommodate teachers and vocational instructors. We just need more of them. But I would be hesitant to come and ask for more FTE or more employees when we have trouble filling the ones we have now. And we're subject to the same issue that we are in correctional officers and maintenance and other areas in that category right now. Like everyone else, we're struggling to hire. So we really need to put a focus on hiring and maximizing the positions we have now. We do that with pay. I'll be talking more about that this session. We have to look at our pay scale across the board. And then I think also we can do it with some outside contracting potentially. We'll be looking at potentially tapping into some revenue generating sources to use some of those funds and monies to apply to vocation, education, substance abuse, these programs that are needed so much. So more to come this session on that for sure. You'll see a strong request from us.
How, as part of the training that you go, me not having sat through one, I don't know what it looks like, having the trainings, do you all talk about the Eighth Amendment at all?
Chair, we do. There's an entire legal section that extensively covers legal challenges relative to the corrections profession. So it's talked quite intensely.
I'll wrap it up. Yes. So in reference to the funding and infrastructure and equipment, in reference to the facilities, I understand the aging buildings, totally understand that. The aspect of the air conditioning and the heating units, how responsive is the staff when facilities are cold or warm, either way, that they're excruciatingly hot? How quickly can we get those specific units or pods taken care of without having a phone call from one of us?
They're responsive. There's been times units have gone down and we get calls. Usually when we get a call, we know about it before we get the call. If a unit if we have a breakdown of a unit, I would say we're extremely, even more so, responsive. We're very aware of the heat and the issues in a lot of the prisons, but we do compensate with ventilation, proper ventilation. We ensure there's fans. We ensure the heat exhaustion and ventilations are working. In terms of cold, I'm very proactive in to mitigate those issues to the extent we can with blankets, off, you know, heating structures and things like that. But and we're constantly doing requesting information on the operability of our systems. But I won't deny that we have challenges in terms of infrastructure related to heating and cooling.
And finally, Mr. Chair, last committee meeting, thank you, Secretary Dixon. Last committee meeting, I question the procurement aspect of the healthcare component of the procurement aspect. And I don't know, I was told that potentially coming in-house is nearly impossible because of, well, whatever reasons. I have not spoken yet with Adam about it, but there was a report, a healthcare study done by the Florida Department of Corrections on November 13th, 2019, from a company named CGL. And it stated in there that that the outsourcing of our medical services are going to be more expensive than we went in-house. So the challenge would then be is to be able to find the personnel staff to do it in-house. That was the only downsides. But by the same token, on the private sector, it's the same exact thing with we're finding with the. So my question is, has staff, is staff aware of this report? And did we just shelf it? I don't know. I'm trying to figure out what are the steps that we're doing in order to be a little bit more effective and efficient with our taxpayer dollars.
And you're referring to our staff?
Yeah, to our
okay,
staff.
Okay, we'll take that question offline because we're here to talk about human
absolutely.
Staff. Thank you, though, for those questions. Representative Campbell, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you would allow me to ask four questions, I'll make sure this is quick. Secretary Dixon, first of all, let me congratulate you on your position upgrade. It's an honor to be in front of you and to ask you these questions. Secondly is, the first thing I want to ask is, you mentioned about inmate idealist. Can you define what inmate idealist is?
Yeah, inmate idleness, the lack of programs or activity. So in a prison of about 1,500 individuals, you know, you have certain jobs. You have laundry, food service, certain jobs you can assign them to. But the programs are not sufficient to the extent that we can provide activity for all 1,500. So we have a number with very, very little to do. Now, we're extremely grateful for the volunteer program we have. We have a robust volunteer program and a lot of folks in communities all throughout Florida that are willing to come in and provide various programs. But we don't have programs sufficient to keep all of the population active every day. So that's why we're some of the requests that we have this year are tailored around our desire to keep them busy. Just as much of a security component as the staff is to reduce those idle hands, so to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And so my next question is regards to the program resources that you are requesting for. What implementation are you looking at to specifically do for this for the programming resources that you're trying to provide for
Mr. Chair, do more of what's working now. We have an outstanding benchmark system throughout our state. We know what works and what doesn't work. So I just want to expand upon the great programs that are working now. We have CDL programs where we train on simulators. We train individuals how to drive a truck, and they get hired the day they graduate. We have masonry programs, welding programs, where individuals can get jobs or can obtain jobs as soon as they're released. We haven't scaled up to the extent we should. We want to make this more accessible to many, many more and simultaneously address that reentry component that's so important in corrections, as well as reducing that idleness.
Last one. Nope, one more.
One more? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you. And if you could provide...
Representative Valdez took your time.
If you could provide me with that data, I know we're going to be meeting tomorrow, so if I can get that data on there, that'd be great. My last question would be is, you mentioned about the morale of the correctional officers. What would you say is the cause for the increased morale and that?
Thank you. Through the chair, I think where we can credit the most is the significant pay increase that occurred last year. That has so much to do with morale. And then we've tried to make good use out of that internally as well, and just really, really getting out there with the staff, ensuring the directors and the wardens and everyone is out with the staff a lot. And just but I'd have to say the pay increase had the most significant impact.
Thank Thank you. We'll now move to Representative Gottlieb.
Thank you, Chair. Secretary Dixon, I appreciate the work you're doing, and I appreciate your presentation. One thing that, from my perspective, I think is missing as a data point is the prison population. Certainly, think that the guards need higher pay and more training, so on and so forth. But I think it's important for us to understand where are we today in terms of a population compared to the pandemic and pre-pandemic to assess your needs. Do you have any idea where we stand in terms of population?
Sure, through the chair. I can give you some rough numbers or I can follow up with more detail, but please. We're around 83,000 now. We were at our peak years ago, we were up to 102,000, and then we stabilized around 93, and we're around 83,000 right now. The court backlogs had a lot to do with that, and we're expected to grow, though. We know that the population is going to increase.
Okay, I want to limit you to one. We've got at least two more questions. We've got a large stack of appearance cards. Representative Gottlieb, do you have one more? You're done? Okay, thank you. Representative Bracey Davis, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I too will be quick. It's my understanding, again, in my visit to Marion, that paper mail has been eliminated, and there's very limited tablets per a couple hundred people. And part of these resources and equipment in your ask is that to increase tablets so that there could be more tablets per inmate.
Chair, the tablet situation was due to us. It was an internal function where we suspended tablet use for a while we repaired some security risk associated with the system. Regarding mail, there's really no impediment to mail, and any impediment that did occur due to that is about to be corrected. February 10th, we're scheduled to have that behind us, and then we also provide kiosk for access to mail. I just want to be clear that no action we're taking is going to slow down or interrupt the access to mail. Different way of getting it, consistent with most states across the country right now. But we will not slow down access to mail, for sure.
Mr. Chair, may I ask one follow-up?
Just one short one.
Okay. It is really short. It's my understanding that there's been a reduction in GED in the last 3 to 4 years. Any idea why that is?
Mr. Chair, I'd have to check the numbers. I think there's actually been a per capita increase. There may be been a reduction overall, but associated with that population reduction, I think the per capita numbers have held steady. But I can check that out. I will say that COVID, during that, a lot of our processes and movement changed, and we were negatively impacted to some extent during that time period. But I would have to look at the numbers to be sure, but I don't think that's the case, but I can verify.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Beltran, you're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman, and thank you, Secretary. It's always good to see you. The last time I think you came before the committee, obviously a while before the election, we were talking about the vacancy rate and that it was a danger to the inmates and the officers and possibly to the public. And obviously we've appropriated some monies, and I'm very gratified that your agency has been able to mitigate the vacancy rate to the extent it has. But still, if there's a unfilled position, that's a guard who doesn't have a partner, or a dormitory that's not being monitored, or a post that's not being watched, that could be a danger to the officers. It could be inmates could hurt each other. Inmates could escape if the problem's bad enough. What can we do? We're still at 25%. That's, what can we do to get that down further? I note an upward trend. Do you have what you need, or do you need something more so that we can get that rate, down into whatever the frictional vacancy, which I would expect would be in the single digits? If you disagree with anything I said, please let me know that as well.
Through the chair, I absolutely agree. I think the answer to that is we do more of what we're doing. We do more of what's working, and what we did last year is working. We want to see the uphill trend line increase at a more rapid pace, because you are correct. And I guess to answer Representative Campbell's question earlier, what improved morale, I would say hope. See, the staff seeing the trend line, 10 or 11 months ago, staff were well aware that every single month we were losing 200 more staff than we were gaining. And staff were well aware of that trend line, and they were well aware of it in reality, because in their housing units they saw less and less people. They saw empty posts and the danger increasing. But now not only do they see that trend line reflecting that we're hiring 200 more a month than we're losing, so a net difference of about 400 prior to the last few months in the holidays, but they're also feeling that in the institutions. And although they don't have instant relief, and they know that we've hired people that have to go be trained, they're seeing the numbers start to increase in so many institutions across Florida, and that's given them a great deal of hope that we're doing the right things, that we're aware of what the issues are, and we're addressing them. So to sum that up, pay. We will be talking about pay again this year to continue to keep us in the right place relative to other law enforcement agencies and employers throughout Florida. The continued programs that all officers know are necessary to occupy the inmates' time and the infrastructure improvements.
Representative Jock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Secretary, for your service to our state in this very important role. Regarding substance abuse and mental health services, does that fall under programming resources? And if so, or if not, what are you seeing as far as those categories, as far as services that are needed within our prisons?
You recognize
it? Mr. Chair, it does. It falls under two categories. It falls under so much of it falls under a programming category. That is true, substance abuse and many other areas. And then part of it falls under our mental and medical contract. So we're addressing those needs through the procurement, the medical procurement that's going on now, and trying to address the substance abuse needs through the programming request that we'll have this year.
Vice Chairman Smith.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Secretary, for being here. As others have talked about, the updates are very encouraging. I appreciate the work that you've done for the corrections officers to keep that morale high, and I think the legislature will be receptive to doing, as you've mentioned a couple times, of doing what's working and handling the issue with compression for those veteran corrections officers. But one of the things, and this may be more of a statement than a question, but I'd ask you to consider, is one of the other things that is working that I've seen with my own eyes as I've toured facilities is work release programs. Yet when I've been out there, I've seen work release programs with significant vacancies. So I'd ask you to just maybe consider looking at the classification of the number of people that we could get out into those programs that work, because as you've spoken about idleness, well, when they're out in a work release program and they're working and they're contributing to themselves and planning for that reentry, I think that is a path to success. I just ask you to consider that.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Any other questions? If not, we've got a lot of appearance cards. Secretary, we thank you for those answers. That was a wide-ranging set of topics, and we appreciate your answers and your input. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Fielder, for being here, too. We appreciate you. We have several appearance cards, so I will limit the appearance, a public appearance, to 2 minutes in the interest of time. We will start with Connie Edson. Connie Edson, if she's here, you're welcome to come forward. You're top of my list here.
Great. Hi, everyone. I'm Connie Edson. A lot of you know me as the air conditioning lady. A few years ago, I found out that our Florida state prisons do not have air conditioning. With that being said, I set on a quest to find a solution. And this was the viable solution I found. These are portable air units. They're kind of like a swamp unit, but they're industrial sized, and they're patented only by this company to be in correctional institutions across the country right now. They plug into a regular outlet, they fill up with a garden hose, and they can hold up to 6,000 gallons of water. So they're portable. We don't have to put one in every room. They have handles, they have wheels. Demonstration was done with the Florida Department of Corrections last June at Marion County, and they did a mechanics room, and it cooled it off in 5 minutes. So something like this, we don't have to put it stationary. We don't have to put it in every room. When they have to go, they can say, hey, guys, we got to go, unplug it, and here we go, and they take it with them. But what's nice about this, they also can be stationary. In the dorms that hold 80 people in hot, 110, you know, really hot out, they have they can be stationary, one on one side, one on the other. These old buildings were built back in the 70s, 60s, in lieu of the future. So they are all built on pipes, water pipes. So when the demonstration was done, the rep told me that they were excited because they won't have to do really anything major. You know what I'm saying? It's not going to be costly. And they can put it without a garden hose right into the plumbing right there. It's cost-effective. It is the only cost-effective way to do it because we're not going to tear down any of these facilities. And the time that we're going to build one, I'll be dead. But I mean, the point is we have to do something now. And waiting every year the heat index gets higher and higher, and they're wearing two layers of clothing. But as you talk about correctional officers and why you can't hire any, I have a few friends that are correctional officers. They've been in the system, and they love it. And they said, who wouldn't want to work for the government? It's a good-paying job, especially with the pay raise. You get a bonus. Plus, you have a future. You have health. It's a great family job. Problem is, they tell me, they train for 3 months. They're wearing the two layers of clothing. They get their bonus. But what happens is they're trained in an air-conditioned facility. So then when they go in the field, they find out it's un-air-conditioned.
Isn't you got about 10 more seconds?
Okay, so with that being said, I just want to, you're asked, probably going to wonder where we're going to get the money from, and I want to know, tell you about the annual inmate trust fund. This is a fund that's totally generated funds by the inmates and their families. Not a dime is taxpayer money. Every year we make $40 million, and we have enough money for Secretary Dixon's programs, the air conditioning, but it goes into your general fund to do what you need to do. So we're all up here asking for money when we already have the money that's funded by our families and the incarcerated. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms.
And if you have any questions.
We appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Kim White is up next. Kim White.
Hi.
Welcome.
I'll start talking now. I'm Kim White. I'm from Orange County. I just want to say that the same thing. We do need more programs. There is a lot of idleness. The trust fund would be a way to get some money for some programs because that would help with rehabilitation so people don't reoffend when they get out. We have so many people that could be safely released into work release, into halfway houses, which would save the state and taxpayers, like all of us, a lot of money. The people would be working. They would be helping to support their family, and they would be out in the community, and they would be being overseen by somebody, you know, in like the probation department or if it's a house thing. You know, there are ways to down our costs and uncrowd our prisons. We have the shortage of over 20%, and this release program would also help that. And that's what I have to say. And please support any gain time bills that come up for those releases to help us save money and to help the people that can be safely released, because we should imprison people we're afraid of, not the ones that made us mad.
Thank you, Ms. White. Amy McCourt. Amy McCourt. Welcome.
I will. I was going to waive my time, but this gentleman spoke about mental health and addiction treatment, and I just wanted to state that right now, as it is, in order to get any type of intensive treatment for addiction while you're in prison, which a vast majority of people in prison have some type of mental health or addiction problem, you have to have, I always get confused, I'm sorry if it's under 3 years or under 2 years, but you, unless you have a very little bit of time left in prison, you're not getting any type of significant treatment for addiction. And I would love to see when we're incorporating, you know, this money for programming and treatment of, you know, care, that there's focus put on that, because there's a lot of people with a lot of time who need a lot of mental health and addiction treatment, specifically drug addiction. We know that that's a major problem in our prisons.
Thank you, Ms. Thanks. McCourt. Laurette Phillipson. Laurette Phillipson.
Thank you, Chair.
You're recognized.
As those that don't know me, that I've spoken to before, as you can see by my tag, I was incarcerated in the state of Florida. I believe it was around 2020 there was a presentation that was done on the horrid privatizing the medical system with the Department of Corrections. And in the end, they recommended that it be returned back to the state. Now, I can tell you when I was incarcerated, when I first went to prison, it was operated by the state, and the medical care was far better. During my first few years there, my kidney function tests began to change. The physician immediately filled out the forms that I needed to see a nephrologist. During the time it took to be scheduled for a nephrologist, in came the third-party vendor. That physician canceled my appointment. I was not getting one. During the rest of my incarceration, I continued to grieve as my kidney function tests changed. And then it started involving my GFR, which is your filter rate. Again, still, nothing was done. When I left prison in 2018, I left on stage 3 kidney disease, which I continue to battle today because medical did not handle the issue. Also, you know, there was a gentleman that went to medical for treatment for a boil, and he was treated for an ingrown hair and given hemorrhoid treatment cream. That man died of sepsis. There was another man who went to medical complaining for chest pains. He was given 2 Tylenol and sent back to the dorm.
You got 10 more seconds.
2 days later, he was deceased. I was housed with a woman who died from sepsis because her boil was not treated either. And I have all the names for anyone who wants to see me to provide them to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Phillips. Christy Vieira. Recognize.
Good afternoon. My name is Christy Vieira. First, I want to say that I come from a very strong family, military family, and I'm very disappointed that we are now using our National Guard to fill these spots that when we have so many people incarcerated and not many getting out. I want to speak on the conversation of dental. I'm here today to talk about the dental decisions making when it comes to dental care for FDC. If someone enters a prison and needs a crown, that's understandable that the state would not do it. But if someone in prison needs the basic filling, there is no dentist on staff so that the filling doesn't get done and the person's mouth continues to rot and the point where they need to have a root canal or a crown. It could be done either by pulling the tooth. It shocks the conscious to hear a person had to go to several teeth being pulled because of FDC's inability to provide dental care. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Vieira. Mary Kuntz. Thank you, ma'am. Joanna Slayman. Thank you. Michelle Rothwell. Welcome, you're recognized.
Thank you. My name is Michelle Rothwell. And last year we heard that it would take money to fix some of the problems with the FDC. Well, there was very little improvement. So my thing is, do we just keep throwing money at things that aren't gonna happen? That's one of the biggest issues, you know, like programming and resources for the incarcerated to move forward and to become productive when they do reenter. Also, I'm asking that all FDC staff need to work on communication, on the way that they talk to the inmates, prisoners, and on the way that they talk to the public. Doesn't hurt to smile, doesn't hurt to look us in the eye. I lost my son last week, and I had to ask for an extra hug from my son, and they were just so cold about it, you know. Just have some compassion and let them learn to just know that we're people and our loved ones are people too. You know, not to call them names and then if they say something to us, then they call them snitches. So, you know, just have the training for the FDC officers, just have a little bit more compassion and know that we're all people and we all bleed and we all have feelings. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rothwell. Cynthia Cooper. You're recognized, Ms. Cooper.
I am Cynthia Cooper, and I'd like to address a couple things. First of all, Mr. Dixon's thing, he said that these officers get 12 weeks of training. 12 weeks. 12 weeks. In 12 weeks, they learn how to speak to a person, how to oversee a person. That's not enough training. I walk by TAs all the time and say, what does Chapter 33 say about that when they're saying something? They don't know what Chapter 33 is. They have no clue. They're not being trained appropriately. They're getting little to no training. They don't know what they're even doing when they go in there. They're blind. The inmates and the visitors know more than they do. Second, I'd like to address, several days ago, I was able to listen to a video that Mr. Dixon put out about tablets and phones and the repercussions of being caught and inmate on staff abuse. But what he did not address was the abuse that our loved ones have had to take because of their officers. Murders that are hidden and covered up, not only by staff, but by his office as well. They don't tell the families. They don't release reports. When we request records, we don't get them. The list goes on and on. And I have a short email from an incarcerated person that actually states, and please excuse my language because this is exactly what it says. I apologize before I say it. That the officers came in their dorm and addressed the whole dorm, 75 men, as cocksuckers.
You're down to 10 seconds.
I understand that. I would just like, if you're going to give him money, if you're going to give this department money, they need to be focusing on what's real and stop trying to cover up what they've been covering up.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank you.
Angie Hatfield. Angie Hatfield. James Biardi. It wasn't that I couldn't pronounce. I couldn't read your writing.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Good morning, everyone. I just wanted to come, and I'll keep it very brief. State correctional officers, we have a tough job. I know most of you know that because you've been out at the facilities. I've even seen some of you. It's not an easy job. Would I love the training to be more? Sure, I would. But it's what the department has to work with. But until we get the pay right, every problem that we bring up today is not going to be fixed until you have proper staffing at the facilities. You're not going to get a bunch of volunteers and programs people to come in and say, you know, hey, I'll work there. I heard somebody said, I think the secretary said earlier that he had trouble finding some medical people. We want the facilities to be safe. My members have a right to be safe. And the key to this is two ways. One, we have to be able to hire more people and keep the job of corrections competitive with other law enforcement. Two, we must keep and retain the veterans. They have years of experience that we can't replace overnight. And I encourage you to take action to not only increase the starting pay of correctional officers, but to give to the veterans. I know Representative Snyder, recently you visited a prison where you got to meet some of our lieutenants and captains that are donating money because their comp time is maxed out. That should be a shame that they go to work. They're probably the only people in law enforcement that go to work, they risk their lives and don't get paid for it. So I want to thank you for your support in the past. We need your help. We could change this around, and I have faith that the department and the secretary is on the right course. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Biardi. That's my last appearance card. I want to thank all of our presenters today for their time and the information they provided today on a small sample of issues that are impacting their respective departments. Thank you to the public that made the trip to Tallahassee today to come and address us. Members, today's presentations represent just a few of the issues that are impacting the departments under our committee's purview. Those issues, as well as many others, will have impacts on the decisions made when forming the Justice Appropriations Budget. I look forward to continuing to work with you on these important issues as we develop budget recommendations for this upcoming session. If there are any issues that you have or other questions about want more information on, please let me or the staff know, and we will make every attempt to provide the information that you have requested. Unless there is any other member that has any other business which should properly be presented, and I don't see any, I see that Representative Snyder, did I call you Smiter? Snyder?
Snyder, excuse me.
Snyder moves, we rise.
Chairman.
Without objection, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
I like it. Spider-Man.
Spider.
Brother, good to see you, man.